This is Kurt Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, welcoming you to our readings from Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl. With me today are Randy Wasserstrom and Susie Pratt. Randy will be reading the introductory material, and Susie will be reading the actual diary entries written by Anne. This show is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Feel free to call us with any comments or suggestions about this show or any other subject pertaining to TRRS. We're here to serve our listeners, and your input will help us do a better job. The number is 919-832-5138. Once again, that's 919-832-5138. You can also visit our website at www.triangleReadingService.org. Thanks again for joining us.
The Diary of a Young Girl, the Definitive Edition, Anne Frank, edited by Otto H. Frank and Miriam Pressler, translated by Susan Masotti. Anne Frank's The Diary of a Young Girl is among the most enduring documents of the 20th century. Since its publication in 1947, it has been read by tens of millions of people all over the world. It remains a beloved and deeply admired testament to the indestructible nature of the human spirit. Restored in this definitive edition are diary entries that had been omitted from the original edition. These passages, which constitute 30% more material, reinforce the fact that Anne was first and foremost a teenage girl, not a remote and flawless symbol. She fretted about and tried to cope with her own emerging sexuality. Like many young girls, she often found herself in disagreement with her mother. And like any teenager, she veered between the carefree nature of a child and the full-fledged sorrow of an adult. Anne emerges more human, more vulnerable, and more vital than ever. Anne Frank and her family, fleeing the horrors of Nazi occupation, hid in the back of an Amsterdam warehouse for 2 years. She was 13 when the family went into the secret annex, and in these pages she grows to be a young woman and a wise observer of human nature as well. With unusual insight, she reveals the relations between 8 people living under extraordinary conditions, facing hunger, the ever-present threat of discovery and death, complete estrangement from the outside world, and above all, the boredom, the petty misunderstandings, and the frustrations of living under such unbearable strain in such confined quarters. A timely story rediscovered by each new generation, The Diary of a Young Girl stands without peer. For both young readers and adults, it continues to bring to life this young woman who for a time survived the worst horror the modern world had seen, and remained triumphantly and heartbreakingly human throughout her ordeal. For those who know and love Anne Frank, the definitive edition is a chance to discover her anew. For readers who have not yet encountered her, this is the edition to cherish. Anne Frank was born on June 12, 1929. She died while imprisoned at Bergen-Belsen, 3 months short of her 16th birthday. Otto H. Frank was the only member of his immediate family to survive the Holocaust. He died in 1980. Miriam Pressler is a popular writer of books for young adults. She lives in Germany. Translated by Susan Masotti. Foreword. Anne Frank kept a diary from June 12, 1942 to August 1, 1944. Initially, she wrote it strictly for herself. Then one day in 1944, Gerrit Bolkestein, a member of the Dutch government in exile, announced in a radio broadcast from London that after the war, he hoped to collect eyewitness accounts of the suffering of the Dutch people under the German occupation, which could be made available to the public. As an example, he specifically mentioned letters and diaries. Impressed by this speech, Anne Frank decided that when the war was over, she would publish a book based on her diary. She began rewriting and editing her diary, improving on the text, omitting passages she didn't think were interesting enough, and adding others from memory. At the same time, she kept up her original diary. In the scholarly work, The Diary of Anne Frank, the critical edition, 1989, Anne's first unedited diary is referred to as Version A, to distinguish it from her second edited diary, which is known as Version B. The last entry in Anne's diary is dated August 1, 1944. On August 4, 1944, the eight people hiding in the secret annex were arrested. Miep Gies and Bep Skulchul, the two secretaries working in the building, found Anne's diary strewn all over the floor. Miep Gies tucked them away in a desk drawer for safekeeping. After the war, when it became clear that Anne was dead, she gave the diaries unread to Anne's father, Otto Frank. After long deliberation, Otto Frank decided to fulfill his daughter's wish and publish her diary. He selected material from versions A and B, editing them into a shorter version later referred to as version C. Readers all over the world know this as the Diary of a Young Girl. In making his choice, Otto Frank had to bear several points in mind. To begin with, the book had to be kept short so that it would fit with a series put out by the Dutch publisher. In addition, several passages dealing with Anne's sexuality were omitted. At the time of the diary's initial publication in 1947, it was not customary to write openly about sex, and certainly not in books for young adults. Out of respect for the dead, Otto Frank also omitted a number of unflattering passages about his wife and the other residents of the secret annex. Anne Frank, who was 13 when she began her diary and 15 when she was forced to stop, wrote without reserve about her likes and dislikes. When Otto Frank died in 1980, he willed his daughter's manuscripts to the Netherlands State Institute for War Documentation in Amsterdam. Because the authenticity of the diary had been challenged ever since its publication, the Institute for War Documentation ordered a thorough investigation. Once the diary was proved beyond a shadow of a doubt to be genuine, it was published in its entirety, along with the results of an exhaustive study. The critical edition contains not only versions A, B, and C, but also articles on the background of the Frank family, the circumstances surrounding their arrest and deportation, and the examination into Anne's handwriting, the document, and the materials used. The Anne Frank Fonds, Anne Frank Foundation, in Basel, Switzerland, which is Otto Frank's sole heir, had also inherited his daughter's copyrights, then decided to have a new expanded edition of the diary published for the general readers. This new edition in no way affects the integrity of the old one originally edited by Otto Frank, which brought the diary and its message to millions of people. The task of completing the expanded edition was given to the writer and translator Miriam Pressler. Otto Frank's original selection has also been supplemented with passages from Anne's A and B versions. Miriam Pressler's definitive edition, approved by the Anne Frank Fonds Foundation, contains approximately 30% more material and is intended to give the reader more insight into the world of Anne Frank. In reading her second version, B, Anne invented pseudonyms for the people who would appear in her book. She initially wanted to call herself Anne Aulis and later Anne Robin. Otto Frank opted to call his family by their own names and to follow Anne's wishes with regard to the others. Over the years, the identity of the people who helped the family in the secret annex has become common knowledge. In this edition, the helpers are now referred to by their real names, as they so justly deserve to be. All other persons are named in accordance with the pseudonyms in the critical edition. The Institute for War Documentation has arbitrarily assigned initials to those persons wishing to remain anonymous. The real names of the other people hiding in the secret annex are the Van Pels family from Osnabrück, Germany, August Van Pels, born September 9, 1890, Herman Van Pels, born March 31, 1889, Peter Van Pels, born November 8, 1926. Called by Anne in her manuscript Petronella, Hans and Alfred Van Dam, and in this book Petronella, Herman and Peter Van Dam. Fritz Pfeiffer, born April 30, 1889, in Gießen, Germany, called by Anne in her manuscript and in the book Alfred Dussel.
Ihr werdet hier. June 12, 1942. I hope I will be able to confide everything to you, as I have never been able to confide in anyone, and I hope you will be a great source of comfort and support. Comment added by Anne on September 28, 1942. So far you truly have been a real source of comfort to me, and so has Kitty, whom I now write to regularly. This way of keeping a diary is much nicer, and now I can hardly wait for those moments when I'm able to write in you. Oh, I'm so glad I brought you along. Sunday, June 14, 1942. I'll begin from the moment I got you, the moment I saw you lying on the table among my other birthday presents. I went along when you were bought, but that doesn't count. On Friday, June 12th, I was awake at 6 o'clock, which isn't surprising since it was my birthday, but I'm not allowed to get up at that hour, so I had to control my curiosity until 6:45. When I couldn't wait any longer, I went to the dining room where Morcha, the cat, welcomed me by rubbing against my legs. A little after 7, I went to Daddy and Mama and then to the living room to open my presents, and you were the first thing I saw. Maybe one of my nicest presents. Then a bouquet of roses, some peonies, and a potted plant. From Daddy and Mama I got a blue blouse, a game, a bottle of grape juice, which to my mind tastes a bit like wine. After all, wine is made from grapes. A puzzle, a jar of cold cream, 2.5 guilders, and a gift certificate for 2 books. I got another book as well, Camera Obscura. But Margot already has it, so I exchanged mine for something else. A platter of homemade cookies, which I made myself, of course, since I've become quite an expert at baking cookies. Lots of candy and a strawberry tart for Mother. And a letter from Grammy right on time, but of course that was just a coincidence. Then Hanalei came to pick me up, and we went to school. During recess, I passed out cookies to my teachers in my class, and then it was time to get back to work. I didn't arrive home until 5, since I went to the gym with the rest of the class. I'm not allowed to take part because my shoulders and hips tend to get dislocated. As it was my birthday, I got to decide which game my classmates would play, and I chose volleyball. Afterward, they all danced around me in a circle and sang happy birthday. When I got home, Sana Lederman was already there. Ilse Wagner, Hanalei Gosler, and Jacqueline Van Marsen came home with me after gym, since we're in the same class. Hanalei and Sana used to be my 2 best friends. People who saw us together used to say, "There goes Anne, Hanna, and Sani." I only met Jacqueline Van Marsen when I started at the Jewish Lyceum, and now she's my best friend. Ilse is Hanalei's best friend, and Sani goes to another school and has friends there. They gave me a beautiful book, Dutch Sassus and Leesens, but they gave me volume 2 by mistake, so I exchanged 2 other books for volume 1. Aunt Helene brought me a puzzle, Aunt Stephanie a darling brooch, and Aunt Leni a terrific book, Daisy Goes to the Mountains. This morning I lay in the bathtub thinking how wonderful it would be if I had a dog like Rin Tin Tin. I'd call him Rin Tin Tin too, and I'd take him to school with me where he could stay in the janitor's room or by the bicycle racks when the weather was good. Monday, June 15th, 1942. I had my birthday party on Sunday afternoon. The Rin Tin Tin movie was a big hit with my classmates. I got 2 brooches, a bookmark, and 2 books. I'll start by saying a few things about my school and my class, beginning with the students. Betty Blumendale looks kind of poor, and I think she probably is. She lives on some obscure street in West Amsterdam, and none of us know where it is. She does very well at school, but that's because she works so hard, not because she's so smart. She's pretty quiet. Jacqueline Van Marsen is supposedly my best friend, but I've never had a real friend, At first I thought Jackie would be one, but I was badly mistaken. DQ. Initials have been assigned at random to those persons who prefer to remain anonymous. Is a very nervous girl who's always forgetting things, so the teachers keep assigning her extra homework as punishment. She's very kind, especially to GZ. ES. Talks so much it isn't funny. She's always touching your hair or fiddling with your buttons when she asks you something. They say she can't stand me, but I don't care since I don't like her much either. Henny Metz is a nice girl with a cheerful disposition, except that she talks in a loud voice and is really childish when we're playing outdoors. Unfortunately, Henny has a girlfriend named Beppy who's a bad influence on her because she's dirty and vulgar. J.R., I could write a whole book about her. Jay is a detestable, sneaky, stuck-up, two-faced gossip who thinks she's so grown up. She's really got Jackie under her spell, and that's a shame. Jay is easily offended, bursts into tears at the slightest thing, and to top it all off is a terrible show-off. Miss Jay always has to be right. She's very rich and has a closet full of the most adorable dresses that are way too old for her. She thinks she's gorgeous, but she's not. Jay and I can't stand each other. Ilsa Wagner is a nice girl with a cheerful disposition, but she's extremely finicky and can spend hours moaning and groaning about something. Ilsa likes me a lot. She's very smart, but lazy. Hannah Lee Gosler, or Lies as she's called at school, is a bit on the strange side. She's usually shy, outspoken at home, but reserved around other people. She blabs whatever you tell her to her mother, but she says what she thinks, and lately I've come to appreciate her a great deal. Nanny Van Prague Cigar is small, funny, and sensible. I think she's nice. She's pretty smart. There isn't much else you can say about Nanny. Efcha De Jong is, in my opinion, terrific. Though she's only 12, she's quite the lady. She acts as if I were a baby. She's also very helpful, and I like her. GZ is the prettiest girl in our class. She has a nice face, but is kind of dumb. I think they're going to hold her back a year. But of course, I haven't told her that. Comment added by Anne at a later date. To my great surprise, GZ wasn't held back a year after all. And sitting next to GZ is the last of us 12 girls, me. There's a lot to be said about the boys, and maybe not so much after all. Maurice Coster is one of my many admirers, but pretty much of a pest. Sally Springer has a filthy mind, and rumor has it that he's gone all the way. Still, I think he's terrific because he's very funny. Emile Bonwit is GZ's admirer, but she doesn't care. He's pretty boring. Rob Cohen used to be in love with me too, but I can't stand him anymore. He's an obnoxious, two-faced, lying, sniveling little goof who has an awfully high opinion of himself. Max Vandebeld is a farm boy from Medemblik, but eminently suitable, as Margot would say. Herman Koopman also has a filthy mind, just like Jopie DeBeer, who's a terrible flirt and absolutely girl crazy. Leo Blom is Jopie DeBeer's best friend, but has been ruined by his dirty mind. Albert de Mesquita came from the Montessori school and skipped a grade. He's really smart. Leo Slager came from the same school, but isn't as smart. Ruth Stoppelman is a short, goofy boy from Almillo who transferred to this school in the middle of the year. C.N. does whatever he's not supposed to. Jacques Cosernout sits behind us, next to C, and we, G and I, laugh ourselves silly. Harry Schopp is the most decent boy in our class. He's nice. Werner Joseph is nice, too. But all the changes taking place lately have made him too quiet, so he seems boring. Sam Solomon is one of those tough guys from across the tracks, a real brat. Admirer. Appy Riem is pretty orthodox, but a brat, too. Saturday, June 20th, 1942. Writing in a diary is a really strange experience for someone like me, not only because I've never written anything before, but also because it seems to me that later on, neither I nor anyone else will be interested in the musings of a 13-year-old schoolgirl. Oh well, it doesn't matter. I feel like writing, and I have an even greater need to get all kinds of things off my chest. Paper has more patience than people. I thought of this saying on one of those days when I was feeling a little depressed and was sitting at home with my chin in my hands, bored and listless. Wondering whether to stay in or go out, I finally stayed where I was, brooding. Yes, paper does have more patience. And since I'm not planning to let anyone else read this stiff-backed notebook, grandly referred to as a diary, unless I should ever find a real friend, it probably won't make a bit of difference. Now I'm back to the point that prompted me to keep a diary in the first place. I don't have a friend. Let me put it more clearly. Since no one will believe that a 13-year-old girl is completely alone in the world. And I'm not. I have loving parents and a 16-year-old sister, and there are about 30 people I can call friends. I have a throng of admirers who can't keep their adoring eyes off me and who sometimes have to resort to using a broken pocket mirror to try and catch a glimpse of me in the classroom. I have a family, loving aunts, and a good home. No, on the surface, I seem to have everything except my one true friend. All I think about when I'm with friends is having a good time. I can't seem to bring myself to talk about anything but ordinary, everyday things. We don't seem to be able to get any closer, and that's the problem. Maybe it's my fault that we don't confide in each other. In any case, that's just how things are. And unfortunately, they're not liable to change. This is why I've started the diary. To enhance the image of this long-awaited friend in my imagination, I don't want to jot down the facts in this diary the way most people would do. But I want the diary to be my friend, and I'm going to call this friend Kitty. Since no one would understand a word of my stories to Kitty if I were to plunge right in, I'd better provide a brief sketch of my life, much as I dislike doing so. My father, the most adorable father I've ever seen, didn't marry my mother until he was 36 and she was 25. My sister Margot was born in Frankfurt in Germany in 1926. I was born on June 12, 1929. I lived in Frankfurt until I was 4. Because we're Jewish, my father immigrated to Holland in 1933 when he became the managing director of the Dutch Opecta Company, which manufactures products used in making jam. My mother, Edith Hollander Frank, went with him to Holland in September, while Margot and I were sent to Aachen to stay with our grandmother. Margot went to Holland in December and I followed in February when I was plunked down on the table as a birthday present for Margot. I started right away at the Montessori Nursery School. I stayed there until I was 6, at which time I started first grade. In sixth grade, my teacher was Mrs. Cooperus, the principal. At the end of the year, we were both in tears as we said a heartbreaking farewell because I'd been accepted at the Jewish Lyceum, where Margot also went to school. Our lives were not without anxiety, since our relatives in Germany were suffering under Hitler's anti-Jewish laws. After the pogroms in 1938, my two uncles, my mother's brothers, fled Germany, finding safe refuge in North America. My elderly grandmother came to live with us. She was 73 years old at the time. After May 1940, the good times were few and far between. First, there was the war. then the capitulation, and then the arrival of the Germans, which is when the trouble started for the Jews. Our freedom was severely restricted by a series of anti-Jewish decrees. Jews were required to wear a yellow star. Jews were required to turn in their bicycles. Jews were forbidden to use streetcars. Jews were forbidden to ride in cars, even their own. Jews were required to do their shopping between 3 and 5 p.m. Jews were required to frequent only Jewish-owned barbershops and beauty parlors. Jews were forbidden to be out on the streets between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. Jews were forbidden to attend theaters, movies, or any other forms of entertainment. Jews were forbidden to use swimming pools, tennis courts, hockey fields, or any other athletic fields. Jews were forbidden to go rowing. Jews were forbidden to take part in any athletic activity in public. Jews were forbidden to sit in their gardens or those of their friends after 8 p.m. Jews were forbidden to visit Christians in their homes. Jews were required to attend Jewish schools, etc. You couldn't do this and you couldn't do that, but life went on. Jackie always said to me, "I don't dare do anything anymore because I'm afraid it's not allowed." In the summer of 1941, Grandma got sick and had to have an operation, so my birthday passed with little celebration. In the summer of 1940, we didn't do much for my birthday either, since the fighting had just ended in Holland. Grandma died in January 1942. No one knows how often I think of her and still love her. This birthday celebration in 1942 was intended to make up for the others, and Grandma's candle was lit along with the rest. The four of us are still doing well, and that brings me to the present date of June 20th, 1942, and the solemn dedication of my diary. Saturday, June 20th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, let me get started right away. It's nice and quiet now. Father and Mother are out, and Margot has gone to play ping pong with some other young people at her friend Tree's. I've been playing a lot of ping pong myself lately, so much that five of us girls have formed a club. It's called the Little Dipper Minus Two. A really silly name, but it's based on a mistake. We wanted to give our club a special name, and because there were five of us, we came up with the idea of the Little Dipper. We thought it consisted of five stars. But we turned out to be wrong. It has seven, like the Big Dipper, which explains the minus two. Ilsa Wagner has a ping pong set, and the Wagners let us play in their big dining room whenever we want. Since we five ping pong players like ice cream, especially in the summer, and since you get hot playing ping pong, our games usually end with a visit to the nearest ice cream parlor that allows Jews, either Oasis or Delphi. We've long since stopped hunting around for our purses or money. Most of the time, it's so busy in Oasis that we manage to find a few generous young men of our acquaintance or an admirer to offer us more ice cream than we could eat in a week. You're probably a little surprised to hear me talking about admirers at such a tender age. Unfortunately, or not, as the case may be, this vice seems to be rampant at our school. As soon as a boy asks if he can bicycle home with me and we get to talking, 9 times out of 10, I can be sure he'll become enamored on the spot and won't let me out of his sight for a second. His ardor eventually cools, especially since I ignore his passionate glances and pedal blithely on my way. If it gets so bad that they start rambling on about asking Father's permission, I swerve slightly on my bike. My school bag falls, and the young man feels obliged to get off his bike and hand me the bag, by which time I've switched the conversation to another topic. These are the most innocent types. Of course, there are those who blow you kisses or try to take hold of your arm, but they're definitely knocking on the wrong door. I get off my bike and either refuse to make further use of their company or act as if I'm insulted and tell them in no uncertain terms to go home without me. There you are. We've now laid the basis for our friendship. Until tomorrow, yours, Anne. Sunday, June 21st, 1942. Dearest Kitty, our entire class is quaking in its boots. The reason, of course, is the upcoming meeting in which the teachers decide who'll be promoted to the next grade and who'll be kept back. Half the class is making bets. GZ and I laugh ourselves sick at the two boys behind us, CN and Jacques Cosernut, who have staked their entire vacation savings on their bet. From morning to night, it's, you're going to pass. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. Even G's pleading glances and my angry outbursts can't calm them down. If you ask me, there are so many dummies that about a quarter of the class should be kept back, but teachers are the most unpredictable creatures on earth. Maybe this time they'll be unpredictable in the right direction for a change. I'm not so worried about my girlfriends and myself. We'll make it. The only subject I'm not sure about is math. Anyway, all we can do is wait. Until then, we keep telling each other not to lose heart. I get along pretty well with all my teachers. There are 9 of them, 7 men and 2 women. Mr. Kiesing, the old fogey who teaches math, was mad at me for the longest time because I talked so much. After several warnings, he assigned me extra homework, an essay on the subject, a chatterbox. A chatterbox? What can you write about that? I'd worry about that later, I decided. I jotted down the assignment in my notebook, tucked it in my bag, and tried to keep quiet. That evening, after I'd finished the rest of my homework, the note about the essay caught my eye. I began thinking about the subject while chewing the tip of my fountain pen. Anyone could ramble on and leave big spaces between the words, but the trick was to come up with convincing arguments to prove the necessity of talking. I thought and thought, and suddenly I had an idea. I wrote the 3 pages Mr. Kiesing had assigned me and was satisfied. I argued that talking is a female trait and that I would do my best to keep it under control, but that I would never be able to break myself of the habit since my mother talked as much as I did, if not more, and that there's not much you can do about inherited traits. Mr. Kiesing had a good laugh at my arguments, but when I proceeded to talk my way through the next class, he assigned me a 2nd essay. This time it was supposed to be on an incorrigible chatterbox. I handed it in, and Mr. Kiesing had nothing to complain about for 2 whole classes. However, during the 3rd class, he'd finally had enough. Anne Frank, as punishment for talking in class, write an essay entitled Quack, 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 said Miss Chatterback. The class roared. I had to laugh, too. Though I'd nearly exhausted my ingenuity on the topic of chatterboxes, it was time to come up with something else. Something original. My friend Sonny, who's good at poetry, offered to help me write the essay from beginning to end in verse. I jumped for joy. Kiesing was trying to play a joke on me with this ridiculous subject, but I'd make sure the joke was on him. I finished my poem, and it was beautiful. It was about a mother duck and a father swan with 3 baby ducklings who were bitten to death by the father because they quacked too much. Luckily, Kiesing took the joke the right way. He read the poem to the class, adding his own comments and to several other classes as well. Since then, I've been allowed to talk and haven't been assigned any extra homework. On the contrary, Kiesing's always making jokes these days. Yours, Anne. Wednesday, June 24th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, it's sweltering and everyone is huffing and puffing, and in this heat, I have to walk everywhere. Only now do I realize how pleasant a streetcar is, but we Jews are no longer allowed to make use of this luxury. Our own 2 feet are good enough for us. Yesterday at lunchtime, I had an appointment with the dentist on John Lukenstraat. It's a long way from our school to Stadstimmertunnen. That afternoon, I nearly fell asleep at my desk. Fortunately, people automatically offer you something to drink. The dental assistant is really kind. The only mode of transportation left to us is the ferry. The ferryman at Joseph Isrokod took us across when we asked him to. It's not the fault of the Dutch that we Jews are having such a bad time. I wish I didn't have to go to school. My bike was stolen during Easter vacation, and Father gave Mother's bike to some Christian friends for safekeeping. Thank goodness summer vacation is almost here. One more week, and our torment will be over. Something unexpected happened yesterday morning. As I was passing the bicycle racks, I heard my name being called. I turned around, and there was the nice boy I had met the evening before at my friend Wilma's. He's Wilma's second cousin. I used to think Wilma was nice, which she is, but all she ever talks about is boys, and that gets to be a bore. He came toward me somewhat shyly and introduced himself as Hello Silberberg. I was a little surprised and wasn't sure what he wanted, but it didn't take me long to find out. He asked if I would allow him to accompany me to school. As long as you're headed that way, I'll go with you, I said, and so we walked together. Hello is 16 and good at telling all kinds of funny stories. He was waiting for me again this morning, and I expect he will be from now on. Anne. Wednesday, July 1st, 1942. Dearest Kitty, until today I honestly couldn't find time to write you. I was with friends all day Thursday. We had company on Friday, and that's how it went until today. Hello and I have gotten to know each other very well this past week, and he's told me a lot about his life. He comes from Gelsenkirchen and is living with his grandparents. His parents are in Belgium, but there's no way he can get there. Hello used to have a girlfriend named Ursula. I know her too. She's perfectly sweet and perfectly boring. Ever since he met me, Hello has realized that he's been falling asleep at Ursula's side. So I'm kind of a pep tonic. You never know what you're good for. Jackie spent Saturday night here. Sunday afternoon, she was at Hanalee's, and I was bored stiff. Hello was supposed to come over that evening, but he called around 6. I answered the phone, and he said, "This is Helmuth Silberberg. May I please speak to Anne?" "Oh, hello. This is Anne." "Oh, hi, Anne. How are you?" "Fine, thanks. I just wanted to say I'm sorry, but I can't come tonight, though I would like to have a word with you. Is it all right if I come by and pick you up in about 10 minutes? "Yes, that's fine. Bye-bye." "Okay, I'll be right over. Bye-bye." I hung up quickly and changed my clothes and fixed my hair. I was so nervous, I leaned out the window to watch for him. He finally showed up. Miracle of miracles, I didn't rush down the stairs, but waited quietly until he rang the bell. I went down to open the door, and he got right to the point. "Anne, my grandmother thinks you're too young for me to be seeing you on a regular basis. She says I should be going to the Lohenbachs, but you probably know I'm not going out with Ursula anymore." "No, I didn't know. What happened? Did you two have a fight?" "No, nothing like that. I told Ursula that we weren't suited for each other, and so it was better for us not to go together anymore, but that she was welcome at my house, and I hoped I would be welcomed at hers. Actually, I thought Ursula was hanging around with another boy, and I treated her as if she were, but that wasn't true. And then my uncle said I should apologize to her, but of course I didn't feel like it, and that's why I broke up with her. But that was just one of the reasons. Now my grandmother wants me to see Ursula and not you, but I don't agree, and I'm not going to. Sometimes old people have really old-fashioned ideas, but that doesn't mean I have to go along with them. I need my grandparents, but in a certain sense, they need me too. From now on, I'll be free Wednesday evenings. You see, my grandparents made me sign up for a wood carving class, but actually, I go to a club organized by the Zionists. My grandparents don't want me to go because they're anti-Zionist. I'm not a fanatic Zionist, but it interests me. Anyway, it's been such a mess lately that I'm planning to quit, so next Wednesday will be my last meeting. That means that I can see you Wednesday evening, Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening, Sunday afternoon, and maybe even more. But if your grandparents don't want you to, you shouldn't go behind their backs. All's fair in love and war. Just then we passed Blinkevort's bookstore, and there was Peter Schiff with two other boys. It was the first time he'd said hello to me in ages, and it really made me feel good. Monday evening, Hello came over to meet Father and Mother. I had bought a cake and some candy, and we had tea and cookies, the works, but neither Hello nor I felt like sitting stiffly on our chairs. So we went out for a walk, and he didn't deliver me to my door until 8:10. Father was furious. He said it was very wrong of me not to get home on time. I had to promise to be home by 7:50 in the future. I've been asked to Hello's on Saturday. Wilma told me that one night when Hello was at her house, she asked him, "Who do you like best, Ursula or Anne?" He said, "It's none of your business." But as he was leaving, they hadn't talked to each other the rest of the evening. He said, "Well, I like Anne better, but don't tell anyone. Bye," and whoosh, he was out the door. In everything he says or does, I can see that Hello is in love with me, and it's kind of nice for a change. Margot would say that Hello is eminently suitable. I think so, too, but he's more than that. Mother is also full of praise, a good-looking boy, nice and polite. I'm glad he's so popular with everyone, except with my girlfriends. He thinks they're very childish, and he's right about that. Jackie still teases me about him, but I'm not in love with him, not really. It's all right for me to have boys as friends. Nobody minds. Mother is always asking me who I'm going to marry when I grow up, but I bet she'll never guess it's Peter, because I talked her out of that idea myself without batting an eyelash. I love Peter as I've never loved anyone, and I tell myself he's only going around with all those other girls to hide his feelings for me. Maybe he thinks Hello and I are in love with each other, but we're not. He's just a friend, or as Mother puts it, a beau. Yours, Anne. Sunday, July 5th, 1942. Dear Kitty, the graduation ceremony in the Jewish Theater on Friday went as expected. My report card wasn't too bad. I got 1 D, a C minus in algebra, and all the rest Bs. Well, except for the 2 B pluses and 2 B minuses. My parents are very pleased, but they're not like other parents when it comes to grades. They never worry about report cards, good or bad. As long as I'm healthy and happy and don't talk back too much, they're satisfied. If these three things are all right, everything else will take care of itself. I'm just the opposite. I don't want to be a poor student. I was accepted to the Jewish Lyceum on a conditional basis. I was supposed to stay in the 7th grade at the Montessori school, but when Jewish children were required to go to Jewish schools, Mr. Elty finally agreed, after a great deal of persuasion, to accept Lise Gosler and me. Lise also passed this year, though she had to repeat her geometry exam. Poor Lise. It isn't easy for her to study at home. Her baby sister, a spoiled little 2-year-old, plays in her room all day. If Gabby doesn't get her way, she starts screaming, and if Lise doesn't look after her, Mrs. Gosler starts screaming, so Lise has a hard time doing her homework. And as long as that's the case, the tutoring she's been getting won't help much. The Gosler household is really a sight. Mrs. Gosler's parents live next door, but eat with the family. Then there's the hired girl, the baby, the always absent-minded and absent Mr. Gosler, and the always nervous and irritable Mrs. Gosler, who's expecting another baby. Lise, who's all thumbs, gets lost in the mayhem. My sister Margot also got her report card. Brilliant, as usual. If we had such a thing as cum laude, she would have passed with honors. She's so smart. Father has been home a lot lately. There's nothing for him to do at the office. It must be awful to feel you're not needed. Mr. Kleiman has taken over Opecta, and Mr. Kugler, Guys and Company, the company dealing in spices and spice substitutes that was set up in 1941. A few days ago, we were taking a stroll around our neighborhood square. Father began to talk about going into hiding. He said it would be very hard for us to live cut off from the rest of the world. I asked him why he was bringing this up now. "Well, Anne," he replied, You know that for more than a year, we've been bringing clothes, food, and furniture to other people. We don't want our belongings to be seized by the Germans. Nor do we want to fall into their clutches ourselves, so we'll leave of our own accord and not wait to be hauled away. But when, Father? He sounded so serious that I felt scared. Don't you worry. We'll take care of everything. Just enjoy your carefree life while you can. That was it. Oh, may these somber words not come true for as long as possible. The doorbell's ringing. Hello's here. Time to stop. Yours, Anne. Wednesday, July 8th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, it seems like years since Sunday morning. So much has happened. It's as if the whole world had suddenly turned upside down. But you can see, Kitty, I'm still alive, and that's the main thing, Father says. I'm alive all right, but don't ask where or how. You probably don't understand a word I'm saying today, so I'll begin by telling you what happened Sunday afternoon. At 3 o'clock, Hello had left but was supposed to come back later. The doorbell rang. I didn't hear it since I was out on the balcony, lazily reading in the sun. A little while later, Margot appeared in the kitchen doorway, looking very agitated. Father has received a call-up notice from the SS, she whispered. Mother has gone to see Mr. Van Dan. Mr. Van Dan is Father's business partner and good friend. I was stunned. A call-up. Everyone knows what that means. Visions of concentration camps and lonely cells race through my head. How could we let Father go to such a fate? Of course he's not going, declared Margot as we waited for Mother in the living room. Mother's gone to Mr. Van Dan to ask whether we can move to our hiding place tomorrow. The Van Dans are going with us. There will be 7 of us all together. Silence. We couldn't speak. The thought of Father off visiting someone in the Jewish hospital and completely unaware of what was happening, the long wait for Mother, the heat, the suspense, all this reduced us to silence. Suddenly the doorbell rang again. That's Hello, I said. Don't open the door, exclaimed Margot to stop me. But it wasn't necessary, since we heard Mother and Mr. Van Dan downstairs talking to Hello. And then the two of them came inside and shut the door behind them. Every time the bell rang, either Margot or I had to tiptoe downstairs to see if it was Father, and we didn't let anyone else in. Margot and I were sent from the room as Mr. Van Dan wanted to talk to Mother alone. When she and I were sitting in our bedroom, Margot told me that the call-up was not for Father, but for her. At this second shock, I began to cry. Margot is 16. Apparently, they want to send girls her age away on their own. But thank goodness she won't be going. Mother had said so herself, which must be what Father had meant when he talked to me about our going into hiding. Hiding. Where would we hide? In the city? In the country? In a house? In a shack? When? Where? How? These were questions I wasn't allowed to ask, but they still kept running through my mind. Margot and I started packing our most important belongings into a school bag. The first thing I stuck in was this diary, and then curlers, handkerchiefs, school books, a comb, and some old letters. Preoccupied by the thought of going into hiding, I stuck the craziest things in the bag, but I'm not sorry. Memories mean more to me than dresses. Father finally came home around 5 o'clock, and we called Mr. Kleiman to ask if he could come by that evening. Mr. Van Dan left and went to get Miep. Miep arrived and promised to return later that night, taking with her a bag full of shoes, dresses, jackets, underwear, and stockings. After that, it was quiet in our apartment. None of us felt like eating. It was still hot, and everything was very strange. We had rented our big upstairs room to Mr. Goldschmidt, a divorced man in his 30s, who apparently had nothing to do that evening since, despite all our polite hints, he hung around until 10 o'clock. Miep and Jan Geis came at 11. Miep, who's worked for Father's company since 1933, has become a close friend, and so has her husband Jan. Once again, shoes, stockings, books, and underwear disappeared into Miep's bag and Jan's deep pockets. At 11:30, they too disappeared. I was exhausted, and even though I knew it would be my last night in my own bed, I fell asleep right away and didn't wake up until Mother called me at 5:30 the next morning. Fortunately, it wasn't as hot as Sunday. A warm rain fell throughout the day. The four of us were wrapped in so many layers of clothes, it looked as if we were going off to spend the night in a refrigerator, and all that just so we could take more clothes with us. No Jew in our situation would dare leave the house with a suitcase full of clothes. I was wearing 2 undershirts, 3 pairs of underpants, a dress, and over that a skirt, a jacket, a raincoat, 2 pairs of stockings, heavy shoes, a cap, a scarf, and lots more. I was suffocating even before we left the house, but no one bothered to ask me how I felt. Margot stuffed her school bag with school books, went to get her bicycle, and with Miep leading the way, rode off into the great unknown. At any rate, that's how I thought of it, since I still didn't know where our hiding place was. At 7:30, we too closed the door behind us. Morcha, my cat, was the only living creature I said goodbye to. According to a note we left for Mr. Goldschmidt, she was supposed to be taken to the neighbors who would give her a good home. The stripped beds, the breakfast things on the table, the pound of meat for the cat in the kitchen, all of these created the impression that we'd left in a hurry. But we weren't interested in impressions. We just wanted to get out of there, to get away and reach our destination in safety. Nothing else mattered. More tomorrow. Yours, Anne. Thursday, July 9th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, so there we were, Father, Mother, and I, walking in the pouring rain, each of us with a school bag and a shopping bag filled to the brim with the most varied assortment of items. The people on their way to work at that early hour gave us sympathetic looks. You could tell by their faces that they were sorry they couldn't offer us some kind of transportation. The conspicuous yellow star spoke for itself. Only when we were walking down the street did Father and Mother reveal, little by little, what the plan was. For months, we'd been moving as much of our furniture and apparel out of the apartment as we could. It was agreed that we'd go into hiding on July 16th. Because of Margot's call-up notice, the plan had to be moved up 10 days, which meant we'd have to make do with less orderly rooms. The hiding place was located in Father's office building. That's a little hard for outsiders to understand, so I'll explain. Father didn't have a lot of people working in his office, just Mr. Kugler, Mr. Kleiman, Miep, and a 23-year-old typist named Bep Voskuhl, all of whom were informed of our coming. Mr. Voskuhl, Bep's father, works in the warehouse along with 2 assistants, none of whom were told anything. Here's a description of the building. The large warehouse on the ground floor is used as a workroom and storeroom and is divided into several different sections, such as the stockroom and the milling room where cinnamon, cloves, and a pepper substitute are ground. Next to the warehouse doors is another outside door, a separate entrance to the office. Just inside the office door is a second door, and beyond that a stairway. At the top of the stairs is another door with a frosted window on which the word office is written in black letters. This is the big front office, very large, very light, and very full. Bep, Miep, and Mr. Kleiman work there during the day. After passing through an alcove containing a safe, a wardrobe, and a big supply cupboard, you come to the small, dark, stuffy back office. This used to be shared by Mr. Kugler and Mr. Van Dan, but now Mr. Kugler is its only occupant. Mr. Kugler's office can also be reached from the hallway, but only through a glass door that can be opened from the inside, but not easily from the outside. If you leave Mr. Kugler's office and proceed through the long, narrow hallway, past the coal bin, and go up 4 steps, you find yourself in the private office, the showpiece of the entire building. Elegant mahogany furniture, a linoleum floor covered with throw rugs, a radio, a fancy lamp, everything first class. Next door is a spacious kitchen with a hot water heater and 2 gas burners, and beside that, a bathroom. That's the second floor. A wooden staircase leads from the downstairs hallway to the 3rd floor. At the top of the stairs is a landing with doors on either side. The door on the left takes you to the spice storage area, attic, and loft in the front part of the house. A typically Dutch, very steep, ankle-twisting flight of stairs also runs from the front part of the house to another door opening onto the street. The door to the right of the landing leads to the secret annex at the back of the house. No one would ever suspect there were so many rooms behind that plain gray door. There's just one small step in front of the door, and then you're inside. Straight ahead of you is a steep flight of stairs. To the left is a narrow hallway opening into a room that serves as the Frank family's living room and bedroom. Next door is a smaller room, the bedroom and study of the 2 young ladies of the family. To the right of the stairs is a windowless washroom with a sink. The door in the corner leads to the toilet and another one to Margot's and my room. If you go up the stairs and open the door at the top, you're surprised to see such a large, light, and spacious room in an old canal-side house like this. It contains a stove, thanks to the fact that it used to be Mr. Kugler's laboratory, and a sink. This will be the kitchen and bedroom of Mr. and Mrs. Van Dan, as well as the general living room, dining room, and study for us all. A tiny side room is to be Peter Van Dan's bedroom. Then, just as in the front part of the building, there's an attic and a loft. So there you are. Now I've introduced you to the whole of our lovely annex. Yours, Anne.
That's all the time we have for today's readings from Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl. Join us at the same time next week. Thanks again for listening. If you know someone who could benefit from our service, point them in our direction. If you know someone who would like to contribute in any way, point them in our direction. Meanwhile, from me, from Susie, from Randy, and from everyone here at Triangle Radio Reading Service, have a nice rest of the day.